Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 217, Happiness and Health, with Dacher Keltner. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So we know in the happiness literature, the healthier the relationships you have is the strongest determinant of your happiness. Good friends, good community members, support groups, family, romantic partners, children, relatives. And so if you pursue healthy relationships, you'll be happy in the long run. And then in my own work and work like it, the more you pursue the context that give you the emotions, the positive emotions that really define your own sense of happiness, be it reverence or ecstasy or awe or gratitude or contentedness, the more you'll be happy.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Dacher Keltner. Dacher Keltner, PhD, received his bachelor's in psychology and sociology from UC Santa Barbara in 1984 and his PhD in social psychology from Stanford University in 1989. After a postdoc at UCSF with Paul Ekman in 1992, he took his first academic job at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and then returned to Berkeley's psychology department in 1996, where he is now a full professor. Dacher's research focuses on two time-honored questions. A first is the biological and evolutionary origins of human goodness, with a special concentration on compassion, awe, love, and beauty. A second is the study of power, status, and social class, and the nature of moral intuitions. Dacher is the co-author of two best-selling textbooks, one on human emotion, the other on social psychology, as well as the book Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, published in January 2009 by W.W. Norton Publishers, which makes the case for an evolutionary approach to the emotions that promote human goodness. Dacher has published over 100 scientific articles. He's written for the New York Times Magazine and Utney Reader, and has received numerous national prizes and grants for his research. And you can find out more about that by looking at the show notes on our site. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dacher Keltner, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's great to be with you, David.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you with us today. I've been tracking developments for some time in positive psychology and just recently learned of your work. I don't know why I'm so late to it, because clearly you've done very significant work. And in addition to being a psychology professor at Cal Berkeley, you are also director of the Greater Good Center. What is the Greater Good Center?
The Greater Good Science Center is an interdisciplinary center that we started at Berkeley about 7 years ago, thanks to gifts from different people, alumni, and the Herb Alpert Foundation. And what we're interested in doing, David, is taking this brand new science that you alluded to in positive psychology, and then more generally the science of compassion and gratitude and altruism, and then translating it to a form in a magazine called Greater Good, and then in a very vibrant website, and then also a parenting blog called Half Full, where people out in the community can put these new ideas and these new scientific findings to use in schools, in teaching, in healthcare practices, in the prisons, in raising kids, in having healthier marriages. And we've been thrilled with how it's going.
Well, I went to that website, as a matter of fact, and was very impressed by it, and also saw the tab for the online magazine at greatergoodmag.org. And I signed up for it. You know, there's so much bad news in the newspapers. And this looks like one of those really important counterbalancing forces.
Well, thanks for getting engaged, David. You know, that is exactly our motivation, which is a lot of the online material, a lot of the blogs, of course, as a lot of your listeners know, a lot of media, sort of mainstream media coverage and television and the like tends to highlight and capitalize on kind of the rare darker sides to human nature. And there is a very upside, if you will, to where humans are going in terms of increasing compassion and increasing empathy and altruism, that we wanted to provide a really sort of rigorous but science-based form.
Well, I noticed you said the rare dark sides of human nature, and I think that many of us have the impression, particularly from the media, that it's not at all rare, but that in fact the dark may be dominating.
Yeah, and you know what I do when I teach human happiness at Berkeley and social psychology, and then in my talks, is I summarize an article by Steve Pinker in Edge, which argues that even though we have these assumptions that the violent and the aggressive and the genocidal is really sort of the core settings, the natural state of human beings, Pinker argues that we actually are moving in a cooperative direction. And I know it's hard for, you know, I had to read the article several times. I wasn't convinced. But, you know, when you look at, as Pinker does, the historical data on how murder rates are down in most European cities in the past centuries, how the rates of torture are down, even though Abu Ghraib and that were certainly alarming. Those kinds of forms of torture used to be very prevalent, less so now. How we treat people with, you know, mental conditions has become much more humane. So I think Pinker suggests that, you know, as Martin Luther King argued, the arc of human history may be toward justice and cooperation. And so I think there's a case to be made for that.
Well, good. I'm glad that that case is being made. It's certainly something that I would like to believe and would like to endorse. Now, your bio describes you as an expert not only in positive psychology, but also social intelligence. And I'm not sure what social intelligence means. Is it the so-called wisdom of the mob, or are you getting at something different?
Well, I think what social intelligence means is, you know, and it really is an extension of Danny Goleman's groundbreaking ideas that I'm sure your listeners have tracked on emotional intelligence.
Yes.
And what Goleman argued is emotional intelligence is our ability to understand other people's emotions, to understand our own emotions, and to put these wonderful things that I've devoted my life to studying, the emotions, to good use in our decisions and our relationships, because they are such essential components of our relationships. And then social intelligence is just broadening out a bit. It's saying, you know, we can be wise to our emotions and other people's emotions, and then just more broadly, we can be wise to other people's thoughts and social intentions and our own, which is what Goleman called social intelligence and in part what I teach in my classes.
Oh, okay. I get it now. So how did you come to be involved with positive psychology?
Well, it was really accidental. So, a lot of the best career developments are accidental and serendipitous. I was a postdoc in Paul Ekman's lab after getting my PhD, and I've spent really the central part of my science and teaching is to study human emotion and the mysteries and of, you know, how we express emotion through touch and the voice and face, just like many of your listeners know about Paul Ekman's work. And what I noticed is the field of emotion that Paul had really pioneered had prioritized the negative emotions. And there were tons of studies on anger and fear, very little on compassion or gratitude. There were tons of studies on fight or flight branches of the nervous system, and we just didn't know much about a caretaking nervous system. And that really piqued my interest to sort of figure out what these positive emotions are. Luckily, Charles Darwin had really written quite extensively in The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals about the evolution of 12 to 15 different emotions that hadn't really been studied scientifically. And so I began my studies of those emotions by looking at laughter and touch and smiling, and that got me connected to positive psychology, which is interested in positive emotion.
Well, you know, quite coincidentally, I'm interviewing Paul Ekman.
No kidding.
Yeah, just 2 days from now, I have an interview lined up with him. And I've actually been sort of chasing him for about 2 years.
So have I.
So I'm glad to finally lined him up. And were you, as you began to head off in this positive direction, were you aware at that time of the, you know, of Martin Seligman's declaration of positive psychology as a new field for psychology, a new direction for psychology to strike out in?
Well, you know, I actually wasn't, and I was, you know, I was locked up in a lab coding facial expressions for 6 hours a day, and we were starting to make all these interesting discoveries. Like, you know, with George Bonanno, we started to find that during bereavement, after you've lost a partner, if you show a lot of laughter and that is correlated with insight into this existential change, you're doing better 2 or 4 years later. I did this funny study that I honestly did not think would work with Leanne Harker, who was a graduate student at the time, where we coded the smiles of women in their college yearbooks from Mills College from 1958. And the warmer, the more friendly the smile, as evidenced in the contraction of the orbicularis oculi muscle around the eyes, which gives you those dreaded crow's feet, warmer smiles predicted really healthier, more connected, more growth-oriented lives in those women for 30 years. And as I started to come up with these findings and started to broaden out my interest in positive emotion, I started to hear wind of, you know, these developments in positive psychology out at the University of Pennsylvania, and then had some interactions with them.
Yes, that's great.
Yeah, it's an important movement.
Yeah, and I come out of a background in humanistic psychology, so
which predates positive psychology.
Yeah, and I was a little miffed.
I know.
But we don't seem to get much credit for that, but I agree. Good. And I also understand that there is a much more of an empirical thrust now, and that's important, so that some of the philosophical ideas that were really espoused by humanistic psychologists, I think, are now being borne out by, you know, people like Seligman and yourself.
Yeah.
And others.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I think that's one of the distinctions is Marty Seligman wanted a science,
yes.
Right? And as people like myself have started to have devoted a lot of time to figuring out how to capture happiness in the face or in the nervous system, there is that opportunity. But humanistic psychology, in my own development, was an important precursor to this.
Yeah, great. Now, I became aware of your work as the result of a flyer advertising some upcoming workshops on happiness and health for professionals that you'll be conducting in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we'll give the dates and times at the end of this interview, and I'll also be sure to put that information in our show notes. But since the title of your workshop is Happiness and Health, without giving the whole thing away, can you say anything about the relationship between happiness and health?
Yeah, what a terrific question. You know, one of the outgrowths of the positive psychology movement that you've alluded to, David, is, you know, it's a really important question, which is, you know, it's one thing to study human happiness. It's one of the oldest questions that humans have been pondering, you know, what makes us happy and good people, and Confucius and Aristotle, and obviously before that, it was a central question. But you know, it's great to study what is happiness, what are the positive emotions, which is what I do, but you can really push it in a more relevant direction, and you can ask, well, what does happiness do for us, right? Is this something that we really need to cultivate? And the origin of the title, Happiness and Health, speaks to some really important discoveries in the past 3 or 4 years on happiness, summarized by Ed Diener and Sonia Lubomirsky in The How of Happiness in her book. And what we've learned is happier people who have a higher balance of positive emotions in their lives, they live longer, right? They're more robust in resisting disease. They are less prone to somatic symptoms and cardiovascular problems. So that's important. We've learned that happier people, you know, again, who cultivate gratitude and appreciation and kindness and the like, they're more productive at work and they're better citizens in organizations. We've learned that happier people are just more robust members of families and communities. And so to me, that's a really important justification for this science of happiness, which is if we can cultivate these things, which is really the thrust of the workshop, maybe our nervous systems will be more robust. Maybe our communities will have, you know, greater cooperation. Maybe our families will be a little bit more resilient. And that gives me a lot of hope.
What was the title of that book again that you mentioned? Was it The How of Happiness?
Sonia Lubomirsky, Lubomirski. It's The How of Happiness from 2006 or 7. And it's a terrific statement about how to cultivate happiness.
Okay, well, we'll have to look into that one. Now, can you say a little something about the neurobiology of happiness? Because I guess, you know, you said that a lot's been discovered in the past three or 4 years, and I guess we're beginning to understand something about the actual circuits, if you will, of happiness.
No, it's astonishing. I mean, the range of findings are, to me, they give me goosebumps, you know. So we knew a lot about, and your listeners, I'm sure, know about cortisol and what we call the HPA axis, which is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that starts in the base of your brain and goes to your adrenal glands in your midsection. And that really is about stress, right? And Robert Sapolsky has really provided a tremendous summary of that. You know, and so the obvious question is, well, where in the body are the neural circuits and the regions of the nervous system that help us connect and help us savor things and take joy and find pleasure? And what we're finding is there are a variety of regions of the brain and the body that are involved in the positive state. So, for example, there's a lot of work on a region in the midbrain called the ventral striatum, which has a lot of dopamine and opioid receptors that the ventral striatum helps people take pleasure in things and find joy in things and savor good tastes and approach their goals, right? So we're starting to learn that region of the brain and dopamine help us go after good things, and then the opioid system kicks in when we accomplish our goals or our strivings and savor things. I study in my lab, and people are starting to investigate this, and I write about this in my book, Born to Be Good, this amazing region of your autonomic nervous system down in the below the brainstem in your body called the vagus nerve. It is unique to mammals. It wanders through your chest and into your intestines and slows your heart rate down, helps you vocalize, stimulates vocal muscle movements. It stimulates the release of oxytocin in your brain, which helps you trust people. And a lot of our studies are finding, as I report on in Born to Be Good, that this part of your nervous system helps us connect to others, to feel resilient, to feel we can handle stress, and to take joy in life. So we're learning a lot about the neurochemistry of happiness.
Yes, it is an exciting time.
It is.
Yeah, your marvelous book, really, Born to Be Good, starts out with a Confucian concept called Jin, J-E-N. Yeah. And you talk about the Jin ratio as a guide to happiness. Maybe you can bring our readers up to speed a little bit on that.
If I could even figure it out myself. Well, here's the thing, David. You know, I was in my lab for the past 10 years. My students and I have been studying compassion and gratitude and awe and reverence, and that slice to human happiness, which humanistic psychology was very much interested in, as you know.
Yes.
Just the appreciation of others and taking profound joy in the moment. And you know, it's funny. I had trouble finding a concept or an idea or word in the English language that captured the spirit of that. And, you know, I was lucky to be raised by a humanistic-type dad who lives in San Francisco. And he always had me reading Eastern philosophy, and so I went back to Confucius. And there, 2,500 years ago, he writes about Jen, or Ren, J-E-N, and sometimes spelled R-E-N. And what it means, it's really about humanity and respect. And so a telling quote is, "A person of Jen brings the good in others to completion and does not bring the bad in others to completion, and brings out the good character of others." And I found that was really the dimension to happiness that I found in our studies was so essential. So then I said, well, you know, how do we put that to use in a more quantitative way? And I came up with this weird thing called the Gen ratio, and it has had a lot of traction. And here's the Gen ratio. In the top part of a ratio, you put all the high Gen moments in your day, right? Someone helping another person cross the street, you volunteer, you exchange some nice smiles with someone as you go through a door, you share some food, whatever it is. In the bottom, you put low Gen moments, which are, you know, when you've brought the bad in others out. You curse at somebody, or you feel frustrated and grumble in a post office line or whatever. And then that gives you a sense of, you know, the bigger the score, the more you're bringing the good to others to completion. And the lower the score, the opposite. And I think that's a good reflection of how happy you'll be in the day and over the long term.
Well, that's fascinating. I think it's the Declaration of Independence that talks about the pursuit of happiness. But is happiness something we can pursue directly, or is it rather a byproduct of other pursuits?
That is a complicated question.
Okay.
So, you know, what wisdom in the Declaration of Independence and to say that we have the right to pursue happiness. And I think, you know, when we unfold the science of happiness, as, you know, and your listeners may be interested, I'm teaching human happiness at Berkeley, and it's podcast, and so you can get it for free off iTunes starting this Wednesday.
Oh, good.
But, you know, when we unfold happiness, what we learn is it's many things, and there are many different forms of happiness that we can try to pursue, be it aesthetic happiness or more compassionate happiness or hedonistic pleasure-oriented happiness. And so your question is, you know, can we really pursue this, right? Is this something that we can actively strive for, or is it really just a byproduct of other activities? And I think you're anticipating the science we'll arrive at in 5 or 10 years. And that is probably the best way to pursue happiness is to anticipate it as a byproduct of mm-hmm. other things. Mm-hmm. And so we know in the happiness literature, the healthier the relationships you have is the strongest determinant of your happiness. Good friends, good community members, support groups, family, romantic partners, children, relatives. And so if you pursue healthy relationships, you'll be happy in the long run. And then in my own work and work like it, the more you pursue the context that give you the emotions, the positive emotions that really define your own sense of happiness, be it reverence or, you know, ecstasy or awe or gratitude or contentedness, the more you'll be happy. So I think it's a byproduct.
Yes. And along those lines, you've also suggested that happiness may be too diffuse a term, masking other important emotions.
Yeah.
Such as gratitude, awe, contentment, pride, love, compassion, and desire. Those are the ones that you kind of list, as well as teasing, touch, and laughter. So I was struck by that. Now, we've all heard of Darwin's survival of the fittest, but I was also struck by a line in your writing that reads, it's a line that you call out, I guess, that maybe that Darwin said, I don't know, or maybe it's your revision, survival of the kindest. Tell us about that.
You know, David, I really appreciate your careful reading because, if there's one thing that astounded me as I wrote Born to Be Good and then have been doing this Darwin-inspired scholarship for 20 years on the positive emotions, it's what you're saying, which is that as a culture, and when I began this work, I assumed that the core processes of evolution, as first thought up by Darwin and, you know, our survival of the fittest processes, right? Competing and looking after number one and being aggressive and having distrusting tendencies or competitive tendencies toward others. And it turns out that's not what Darwin believed. And in The Descent of Man, Darwin's first book on human beings in 1871, which I read carefully as I was heading into writing Born to Be Good, there it is. And Darwin says that we need to be sympathetic as a species because we're not terribly strong compared to other species. We're not fast. And most importantly, as Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy has written, she has a new book out, we have hyper-vulnerable offspring. And without sympathy, our species withers and dies. And he goes on to say, you know, that the communities that have the most sympathetic members will flourish, and sympathy is our strongest instinct and not violence or aggression. And I was just awestruck by that quote. And it says that it's really survival of the kindest and not the fittest. And survival of the fittest was not Darwin's turn, but Herbert Spencer, who wrote about Darwin. And then what I go on to do, and there are a lot of scientists that are working on this, is to show that sympathy is built into our nervous systems. There are genes for it. There are parts of the brain for it. Most people are, in general, more cooperatively oriented towards strangers rather than competitive. There are a ton of data that say Darwin was onto something very fundamental about who we are.
That's fascinating because most of us, myself included, have gotten Darwin second and third hand.
Yep.
And it's just sort of, everybody knows that it's survival of the fittest.
I know. Well, when he became famous in England, he had, you know, a lot of people who started to do his PR work, you know, the Huxley and Herbert Spencer and others, and they started to, you know, and their translations of Darwin were, as always, filtered through their own personal agendas. And both of those guys advocated a very, you know, bloody tooth and claw approach to evolution that we're starting to revise in taking a new look at who we are.
Boy, that's fascinating. I wonder where you come down then on that sort of basic, you know, the question of basic human nature, where people in the humanistic camp have kind of felt that people are born good, and people in the Freudian and other camps, you know, have kind of thought, no, we're basically wild beasts that need to be tamed and civilized.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of that, of one way or the other?
You know what you can, and it's great to hear your historical observations about the humanist response to Freudianism, because, boy, Freud, so wildly influential, those two core instincts of sex and aggression, right? Certainly follows in this more cynical view of human nature, if you will. You know, the way I look at it is couplefold. And one is, let's look at the nervous system, which is, you know, just a bunch of biological processes genetically encoded, shaped by evolution. And there we see both, right? There clearly are fight-flight tendencies rooted in the brain that are controlled by genes. But there are, which is what I profile in the book, there's just this rapid new science on our where cooperation is in the brain, and oxytocin, a little neurochemical that helps us trust others and give. And then the vagus nerve, there are regions of the nervous system that are really devoted to kindness. And then more important to all of us and to your listeners is, well, just, and that's why I challenge the reader with the gen ratio, which is, okay, you know, let's test our intuitions about human nature by just counting what's going on in your daily life. And when I look out in my daily life, I see amazing examples of cooperation and kindness and generosity on a daily basis. And it's the real violent self-interested action that is rare. And then in the book, I cite a lot of examples of people finding this same insight in really counterintuitive contexts, like people writing about war and noting, as Jonathan Glover, the historian, did, that, you know, in war, he writes about this thing called sympathy breakthroughs, where in the heat of combat, it is very common for combatants to collapse and break down because of the sympathy they feel for the people they're supposed to harm. So I come down, David, I'm more of an optimist, I guess, but that we've evolved to be cooperative and kind as default settings.
Yeah. I remember as an undergraduate being in dorm bull sessions in which it was argued that all motivation is at its root selfish, that there's no such thing as unselfish altruism.
Yeah.
And I guess it turns out that this is a fairly long-standing scientific debate and one that you've studied and written about.
Yeah, I mean, that is, it's one of these age-old questions, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
And you can take sort of astounding acts of altruism and, you know, people risking their lives for a stranger. You know, one of the ones that's of interest to me is, and in fact, people are getting interested, like interspecies altruism, right? People will, you know, take risks to save their dog or to save, you know, another animal that they don't have a relationship to. So clearly there are astounding acts of altruism to explain. And the conventional wisdom, you know, the best way that you can really handle this debate about is it selfish or is it really oriented toward enhancing the welfare of others is to define your terms. And the two selfish explanations are really that we help others to reduce our own distress at the sight of their suffering. And then the second one is we help others to derive social rewards for helping, right? People will praise me or think highly of me. And there are conditions that you can create experimentally in which you let people help where there's no way they could derive a selfish benefit, right? They're anonymous. They can leave the context without any consequence. And therefore calm their distress down. And what you find is when people feel empathy and compassion for the sufferer, they help even when there's no selfish benefit to derive at great expense to the self. So that tells us there is some motive in the body that is leading people to be altruistic even when there's no psychologically selfish reason for them to do so. Then you can push it even further and say, well, you know, what's that process in the body that makes us help? And Dan Batson and Nancy Eisenberg have done great work showing it really is this feeling of compassion, elevated activation in the vagus nerve, which I've talked about earlier, that drives this helping. And that tells us at that level of analysis that a lot of helping behavior is driven by a core motive about the other person's welfare.
You mentioned compassion, and compassion's high on the list of Buddhist recommendations for happiness.
Yeah.
And you say there's actually new research that supports the idea that compassion is rooted in our biology. And yeah, what can you say about that?
Well, what we know, for example, is when you ask people, so first of all, our lab has done research showing that when people feel compassion toward a vulnerable person who suffers, they have activation in the vagus nerve. And that bundle of nerves that starts at the top of your spinal cord and wanders through your body helps support altruistic behavior as well. There are new studies of brain regions showing that when we feel compassion, a harm region of the brain called the amygdala lights up, and then the ventromedial prefrontal cortex lights up, which is just part of your frontal lobes. It helps us empathize. Richie Davidson and John Kabat-Zinn have amazing data that when you get, software engineers and ordinary people to sort of do the Buddhist loving-kindness meditations, after several weeks, they get a shift in their resting brain activation to the left side of the frontal lobes. They have more left frontal activation after meditating. And that region of the brain, just the broad left frontal lobes, is associated with approaching and acting and helping. And then there's a little neuropeptide that we've done work on of called oxytocin, which your listeners have probably heard about. It's involved in breastfeeding and milk letdown and uterine contractions and eating chocolate and all this good stuff. Mm-hmm. And a lot of new data show that when we have surges of oxytocin, we feel love and kindness and generosity toward others, even strangers. So all of those studies say that what we once thought of as, compassion is a cultural construction or something that is not part of human nature, it's rooted in our bodies quite clearly.
Okay. Now, on the downside, the dark side, if you will, you cite sure. evidence that video games and violent movies and such may in fact be rewiring young brains in ways that decrease compassion, and that I was shocked to read the study that you quote, that U.S. children rank near the bottom in terms of concern for others.
Yeah. Yeah, so was I, David. It was a UNICEF study, I think, from 2004, and they did a very rigorous survey of I think, 20 or 21 industrialized nations, and they had six measures of social well-being, including concern for others. And these are measures like how healthy they are, do the teachers say they're happy, do they get in a lot of fights and conflict. And our kids ranked 20th out of 21 countries, which is not a good thing. And I think that raises a really interesting, a deep question. I wish this was part of the healthcare debate. It really should be, which is what's going wrong, right, with our kids?
Yeah.
Everybody has a lot of ideas, but coming out of this literature on compassion and happiness, one of the questions you can ask is, do we have broad cultural sources that may be tilting us away from concern for others? To connect to your interest in Buddhism or reference to Buddhism, it's a really interesting connection there because the Buddhists counsel this disciplining of our thought and really training up these more pro-social thought tendencies. And what I challenge my undergrads to is to think about the place of video games and the violence on the internet, right?
Yes.
And there is a survey by Brad Bushman and Craig Anderson on about 25 studies of violent video games, rigorous scientific studies, all peer-reviewed. Your listeners will know the thesis, but it's nice to have the data, which is watching violent video games basically shuts down this compassion-related physiology we've talked about. After you've played a violent video game, you don't care about others, suffering doesn't bother you, you have higher activation of your cardiovascular system and sort of a more fight-flight orientation, you're less generous, you're more aggressive. It's not a good thing. And so I think we have to ask from the Buddhist frame the question of, are these the kind of images and thoughts we want in our minds? And I don't think they are.
And it's not just from a Buddhist frame, but evidently there is science to back that up.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, a sense of meaning appears to be one of the key elements of happiness. And people talk about searching for meaning. In fact, the subtitle of your book, Born to Be Good, is The Science of a Meaningful Life. Is meaning something that is discovered or something that's created? And what's your advice for the person who's having difficulty finding meaning in life?
Well, I think that meaning is both. And I think that it is, you know, it resides within us in terms of the particular genetic profile we're given that in part defines how we will think of happiness, right? Do we think of happiness as some that rooted in the intellectual activities or reverence, or is it something that's really rooted in caring and compassion? And there are many definitions of happiness. So I think that to answer your question, I think it's something that is discovered through self-insight processes and then created. And one of the things that we have very good scientific data on is how personal narratives, really this act of creating our sense of well-being and happiness and meaning, are critical to our well-being and our happiness. There are studies showing when we write about trauma and our feelings and we actively construct the story of our lives, we become more fulfilled and resilient and happy through this creative act of meaning-making. Now, that begs the question of, and I think, and it's to your point, which is, well, what is meaning, you know? And the reason that I titled my book, The Science of a Meaningful Life, is that I write about these really, really the varieties of different positive emotions that give us meaning and happiness. But they're really different, you know? There's the world of laughter and mirth and silliness. There's the world of compassion and caring. There is a world of just basic sensory pleasure. There's a world in the emotional realm of deep appreciation and gratitude. There's the world of desire and passion. We are showing that these are really different kinds of emotions and forms of happiness and play central roles in our how we find meaning in life.
Okay. Well, with so much bad news in the newspapers and the current economic climate, what's your advice for how people can find or stay connected to their own happiness center, if you will? Really easy questions I'm giving you here, right?
God. Oh, no. Well, you know, what I've been really excited by in writing about human happiness, teaching broader courses on human happiness, Berkeley and healthcare lectures and podcasts and the like, is that we now know, thanks to scientific studies, that there are, you know, 8 or 10 really robust, time-honored approaches to cultivating happiness. And what I'm really thrilled about is that none of them cost a lot of money. So in economic downturns or tough times economically, these are readily available. And in fact, may even be more available. Be with other people. Write a narrative about your life. Tell a story, right? Really get into that. We know there's a rich science of giving, and the more you give, the better you are in terms of your happiness. One of the great new studies on this, 2008, Elizabeth Dunn, she found that if people who were given the chance to give away $20 in a day were happier at the end of the day than those who spent the money on themselves. There's a neat literature, and this is so relevant to people in California, and, you know, is immersing yourself in nature gives you boosts of happiness, calms you down. I do a lot of research on touch, and we are a touch-deprived culture. Americans are touchless and touchless than most members of other cultures, and we now know that simple, friendly forms of touch, a pat on the back, good firm hug or a handshake, give people boosts in chemicals that make them healthy and happy. So, you know, there are a lot of really simple age-old ideas of giving, being with others, touching, immersing yourself in nature and art, writing narratives about the life, being silly, that are cheap and easy ways to boost your gen ratio.
Yes, and speaking of touch, I love that portion in your book where you talk about
your
contact with the Dalai Lama and
yeah.
When he shook hands with you. And how that was a special moment. And people should go out and get the book just for that, if nothing else. I did mention that I wanted to make sure that we cited your workshop. So I want to say you have day-long workshops on happiness and health coming up in San Francisco in Palo Alto on September 11th of 2009. Since this may be heard, who knows, years from now. And in San Rafael on September 18th of 2009, and I'm hoping to be at that one.
Great.
And San Francisco on September 26th. And people in the helping and health professions can earn 6 continuing education units. And I'll put the sign-up information in my show notes and my post-interview commentary. So is there anything that you'd like to add about these workshops?
Well, they have been amazing experiences for me because, you know, one of the things that I learned as a lab scientist locked up in a lab trying to figure out the evolution and biology of human happiness and compassion is when I get out and talk to hundreds of healthcare providers who talk about, for example, cultivating the right kind of touch in the therapeutic setting, right, with a schizophrenic patient, or teaching how to make eye contact to an Asperger's child, or sort of cultivating laughter in a grief counseling work group. And these are all specific examples, 3 of dozens that I've got from the participants. I just want the people to know that, you know, we take that wisdom and weave it into our science and our Greater Good Science Center as part of our mission of disseminating this new science of happiness and compassion. So it's been great to learn from the participants.
Well, I have to say I'm really impressed by the science that you're doing and how you can hold all of this information in your head and your dedication to making a positive difference in the world. There have been times in my life where I felt disaffected with the scientific enterprise because so much that's churned out seemed to not be hooked into the world in meaningful ways. And certainly the work that you've described here that you're doing runs so counter to that. It's a wonderful inspiration, I think, to the students that will be following in your wake.
Well, thank you, David, and you just gave my vagus nerve a little boost, so I appreciate
it. Good. Okay, well, Dr. Dacher Keltner, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
David, I really appreciate the thoughtful interview.
I trust that you are as inspired by Dr. Dacher Keltner and his groundbreaking research as I am. The idea that we are wired for happiness and goodness is a revelation, as is the revelation that Darwin saw the evolutionary process as involving the survival of the kindest. We all need to take these ideas to heart, or at least to our vagus nerve. As you heard, Dr. Keltner got his start studying emotion in the lab of Dr. Paul Ekman, who is listed as one of the top 100 psychologists. I'll be interviewing Dr. Ekman just a couple of days from now on my Wise Counsel podcast, so keep your ears to the ground for that. As I mentioned during the interview, Dr. Keltner will be doing several presentations on happiness and health in the San Francisco Bay Area for the Institute for Brain Potential. He'll be presenting in Palo Alto on September 11th, 2009, in San Rafael on September 19th, and in San Francisco on September 26th. For more information on registration and CEUs, go to the Institute for Brain Potential website at www.ibpceu.com. And look for me at the September 19th event. I'll probably be wearing a black shirt that says Shrink Wrap Radio over the breast pocket. Now, in addition to the seminars Dacher's doing for the Institute for Brain Potential, he's also doing a Greater Good Science Center seminar in Los Angeles on September 10th of 2009 with Sonia Lyubomirsky, who he mentioned in the interview, and the title of that presentation is going to be Why to Be Good, How to Be Happy. And his Greater Good Science Center is also hosting a seminar in Berkeley on September 25th, and the title of that one will be Forgiveness and Gratitude, and will feature Stanford's Fred Luskin and Bob Emmons of UC Davis. Now, some of you might recall that I interviewed Fred Luskin about his work on forgiveness on Shrink Wrap Radio number 57 back in April of 2008. You might enjoy reviewing that one in the context of Dacher Keltner's remarks in this current interview. You can get registration information for these presentations at the Greater Good website, which you'll find at http://greatergood.berkeley.edu.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Well, once again, you may be surprised, and I hope delighted, to have this podcast show up just 1 week after the last one with Michael Mead. I accelerated this one as well because I wanted to get the word out about Dacher Keltner's Bay Area presentations in plenty of time for local listeners to be able to take advantage of these announcements. And also, I wanted to make sure I got a show out before next week's trip to Kauai. I might even try to get out one more before my September 4th departure. By the way, I haven't heard from anyone on Kauai. I'm not sure if I have one or more listeners there or not, but if I do, I'd love to meet you. Drop me an email or leave me voicemail and we'll set something up. As I mentioned last time, we have a new sponsor of sorts. If you go to www.behavioralhealthcentral.com and click on the radio tab, you'll find 10 past episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio there. Or you can go directly to those episodes by going to shrinkwrapradiointerviews.com. Since these are old episodes, you may have already heard them. BehavioralHealthCentral.com is a new web portal that has lots of information and links to behavioral health resources, so you might want to check it out. And here's hoping that they decide to pick up more Shrink Wrap Radio episodes on an ongoing basis. Meanwhile, my interview with Ilan Meyer, Ph.D. of Columbia University, on the effects of stress on minority mental health is on my other podcast series at Wise Counsel Podcast. So check that one out if you haven't discovered it already. I could use some volunteer help in constructing a simple banner ad for Shrink Wrap Radio, which I'd be able to post for free at podcastalley.com. My problem is that I don't have the Photoshop or whatever skills to create the ad. It doesn't need flash animation or anything fancy. So please let me know if you'd be willing to create such a thing for me on a volunteer basis, and I'll send you more information. Please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio, and I really appreciate it when you mention it on your Facebook or Twitter or blog. And speaking of blogs, I was recently contacted again by Monica Guardia in Panama, who let me know that a number of Shrink Wrap episodes have been referenced on her Spanish language blog at www.graficosymotivacion.webs.com. It's been a while since we've received any new donations. If you haven't yet made a donation, please look for the big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar on our site. You can make a one-time donation or an ongoing gift for 6 months or for a year. And thank you also for your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, Budget Car Rentals, Angie's List, and Avis Car Rentals. And there will be no more commercial announcements in this episode, I promise.
Hi, this is Jules from the Sunshine Coast, Queensland, Australia, and you're hanging out with Dr. Dave.
Thanks very much for that transition, Jules, there in Queensland, Australia. Sounds like you might be standing in a canyon. Now let's catch up with some listener emails. We have two fairly long ones, so I'll limit myself to just two. And the first one was actually a comment on the site, but I thought it was so good that I wanted to share it as an email. And it's from Michael in New Jersey and reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I wanted to tell you how thoroughly impressed I was with your conversation with Michael Mead. He speaks from genuine experience and avoids the feel-good sound bites of cheap and naive positive psychology." And by the way, I should mention that I don't know what your reaction will be to my interview with positive psychologist Dacher Keltner in this episode, but I certainly wouldn't characterize him as cheap and naive positive psychology. At any rate, back to Michael's letter. He says, "The point raised about the dangers of literalism made me reflect at length. This challenges the polarity established by the religious fundamentalists with their dogma and superstitions and the scientists with their blind faith and empiricism. Though a skeptic at heart, I have to admit that I agree with Mead's implications about the nature of myth. They can't be fully nailed to logical analysis, but to the host of ambiguous experiences inherent in our humanity. Myths are celebration of the mystery of living, and they represent the potential for something more balanced beyond the narrow categories that enslave us. Stories have the power to give us a sliver of understanding if we're willing to immerse ourselves in them. It's no surprise that Mead finds a sense of genuine communication in myths, poetry, and other literature. Social class, age, and background disappear to give way to our common imagination. In the Dalai Lama's The Universe in a Single Atom, he cautions scientists that they must not be dismissive of the subjective side of our humanity. This is precisely what both faith-based extremists and scientists fail to understand. The subjectivity expressed in the world's myths provide that subjective dimension that is so missing in our lives today. Myths also give form to the dreaded darkness that each one of us must face in order to mature in any significant sense. Unfortunately, and as a high school English teacher, I can vouch for this. We have been moving away from the splendors that literature has to offer for some time now. Mead mentioned that a good teacher knows how to awaken a sense of poetic awe in his or her students. I was so touched by this comment. This is quite a challenge when one has to compete with limited attention spans and a culture that holds entertainment as the highest virtue. So much so, in fact, that some things that are just entertaining are confused with being, quotes, educational just because they arouse interest. Myths challenge us to reflect on what it means to be alive and therefore require sincere effort and attention. I'm happy to see someone of Mead's understanding and experience reach out to others on behalf of stories and their importance to our lives. In the recently published Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle by Chris Hodges, there are some bleak statistics about our country's literacy rates in addition to students' lack of interest in the humanities. The Modern Language Association's end-of-year job listings in English literature and foreign languages dropped 21% for 2008-2009 from the previous year, the biggest decline in 34 years. The humanities share of college degrees is less than half of what it was during the mid to late 60s. Only 8% of college graduates, or about 110,000 students, now receive degrees in the humanities. That's why I was so moved by Mead's interview, for he emphasized the purpose of metaphor and nuance in human life. Since so little interest abounds in the humanities, I feel less alone upon hearing of Mead's endeavors. Lastly, I must commend both of you for highlighting a common misinterpretation in Joseph Campbell's work. As you noted, he did say, "Follow your bliss," but this has been taken out of context for convenience. It's not just about imagining what you want and reaching happiness. It's amazing how everything can be twisted to justify self-indulgence. Following your bliss, as you guys conveyed in other terms, also involves the dark night of the soul. This, of course, has nothing to do with the wishful thinking of positive psychologists who peddle their shallow nonsense for profit. Wisdom is to be found in the lasting stories of our world cultures. They are in many ways the conscience and soul of our overwhelming and enigmatic history. They pose the questions that we must ponder for ourselves and provide us with the mysteries that make love and understanding possible. Thank you for an honest discussion. Your shows are excellent, Dr. Dave. Michael in New Jersey. Well, Michael, thanks so much for this communication. I feel blessed to have such articulate and thoughtful listeners as yourself. I agree with almost everything you said. I do have a more charitable view of positive psychologists, however, especially someone like today's guest, Dacher Keltner. I'm guessing that your reference to, quotes, wishful thinking of positive psychologists who peddle their shallow nonsense for profit refers more to certain New Age types, for lack of a better term, than to visionary academics like Keltner. At least, that's what I'm hoping. I'll read one more long one, this one from Chelsea, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, okay, finally, I'm sitting myself down and typing out the email that has been writing and rewriting itself in my head now for nearly a year. Thanks for the welcome on your email list, and I'm very happy to finally be touching bases with you. To be honest, though, I feel as if I'm writing a letter to a dear and cherished friend. Through your podcast, I feel as if I've come to know you personally, almost as if we've been getting together and chatting over a nice cup of tea once a week for the past year." I like that image. "It seems silly since you know so little about me, but maybe this pseudo-relationship will come to be a bit more dialogic now that I've joined the mailing list and taken the time to compose this long overdue message." And by mailing list, I think she's referring to our Yahoo discussion group, which you can find a link to on the site, and you're invited to join us. Chelsea goes on, "So, on to the letter I've been meaning to write. As I mentioned in my email to the mailing list, I've been so grateful to have access to your podcasts as I attend a somewhat conservative and heavily research-oriented university that often frowns upon that which is not accepted by the current scientific paradigm. In my personal life, I've always loved exploring the multitude of wisdom put forth by great minds outside of mainstream psychology, from ancient philosophers to religious gurus to artists to quantum physicists. Don't get me wrong, I have a great deal of respect and admiration for the awesome achievements of science, and I conduct basic research at my university myself. However, I'm an avid learner, and I'm not one to put blinders on as I search for meaning in life. For students like myself, struggling to make their way through school under a pretty tight budget, your podcast is truly a treasure. On to a few highlights of the ideas that have popped into my mind as I've listened to your podcasts. I've been particularly fond of the interviews you've done with experts in Jungian psychology, psychoanalysis, and Buddhism. I really enjoyed your discussion of how Jungian archetypes manifest in films, show number 166, with Dr. John Beebe. I had actually just completed a paper for my clinical psychology course in which I applied Jung's analytical theory to the character of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. It was a really fun project to do, heavily inspired by Joseph Campbell's discussion of the cultural importance of myth and stories with Bill Moyers in The Power of Myth. I was very happy with the paper when I finally completed it, and it was nice to hear some of the conclusions I'd come to in my research on Jung's ideas echoed in your guest's comments. It would be really interesting to hear an interview with a guest who uses Joseph Campbell's ideas in their approach to psychotherapy or psychological research. I wish I had a guest to suggest, but if you stumble across one, I think it would make for a fantastic show. This email is already running quite long, and I did want to give you those suggestions for guests I do have in mind. I was so excited to see you had posted a podcast with yoga in the title. But to be honest, it wasn't quite what I'd been hoping for. It was a nice interview, but I've really been hoping you might do a podcast on the use of yoga in psychotherapy, or how yogic philosophy relates to modern psychological theories of mind. One guest you might consider interviewing is Michael Formica. my absolute favorite blogger on topics related to psychology. He writes the blog Enlightened Living on the Psychology Today website, and his posts on yogic philosophy, the psychotherapeutic process, and the practice of mindfulness are phenomenal. And she goes on to list several of her favorite shows in that series. She says, another person you might consider contacting for an interview is Dr. Richard J. Davidson, a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin who has conducted research on the neurosciences of compassion, love, and forgiveness. I've followed the work that has emerged from Dr. Davidson's lab for my own research on emotion, but most people with any interest in psychology have heard of the study he conducted in which he scanned the brains of several hundred meditating Buddhist monks using fMRI. His close relationship with the Dalai Lama also seems to have heavily influenced his scientific pursuits, and I would very much be interested in hearing more about his thoughts on the overlap between scientific and Buddhist schools of thought. His contact information is available, and she gives his website, which is kind of long, and I'm not going to give it here. And be sure to navigate around the site and to see some of the work he's been doing. I think that's enough for now. I hate to send long, rambling emails. As other thoughts and ideas for guests strike me, I'll be sure to send them your way immediately so they don't all pile up like this. Thanks again for all of the insight and knowledge you've shared with the world, Dr. Dave. I'm looking forward to what you've chosen to share with us later this week. Your friend, Chelsea. Well, Chelsea, your letter is a perfect companion to the earlier one by Michael, another very, very eloquent letter. And the two suggestions that you've made are actually ones that I followed up on. I sort of have dropped the ball with Michael Formica. I got in touch with him and he indicated some interest and he wanted to know what I wanted him to focus on. And I think I wrote back and said, well, pretty much whatever you want. And then I didn't hear back from him. So that's a good reminder that I need to follow up with him and try to retrieve whatever momentum we had going. And I've been trying to get Richie Davidson as a guest on here actually for a couple of years and somehow wasn't getting through to him or he wasn't getting back to me. I can't remember what it was. We have an appointment set up now in November. We had one set up for this week actually, and due to a family emergency, he had to cancel out and give me a rain check. And so now we're set up to do it sometime in November. So that's going to be a really good one that I'm looking forward to. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on specific episodes. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. You're encouraged to leave voicemail on our phone. It's 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Dacher Keltner, for sharing his inspiring work on health and happiness. My next show will very likely feature my colleague, Dr. Victor Daniels, and his wife, Cooch Daniels, speaking about their new book, Matrix Meditations, a 16-week program for developing the mind-heart connection. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.